This is the Water Foresight Podcast, powered by the Aqualaris Group, where we anticipate, frame, and shape the future of water through strategic foresight. Today's guest is Earth and Water Law founder Brent Feewell, who has over 30 years of experience in public policy, advocacy, and environmental law. As an environmental lawyer and former corporate executive and senior U.S. EPA official in EPA's offices of water and congressional and intergovernmental relations, Brent brings a wealth of knowledge and unique perspective to his clients in navigating the regulatory and political arenas in Washington, D.C. Brent, welcome to the Water Foresight Podcast. It's a privilege to have you with us today.
Thank you, Matt. It's great to be with you.
We have just seen the outcome of Sackett versus EPA. And if I recall correctly, this is the second time that the Sackett family has been in front of the Supreme Court, and they have a good batting average. Tell us a little bit about this particular Sackett case, maybe the context, the history in light of the world of water.
Sure. So this is obviously a significant decision. And as you noted, this is the Sacketts' second tour of duty before the Supreme Court. 2012, they went before the Supreme Court on more of an administrative procedural dispute with the agency, and they won that case 9-0, similar to this case. So as you say, the Sacketts have a pretty strong batting record with the Supreme Court. I think it may be helpful to your audience to kind of set the stage here. A few salient facts that I think have been operative of this case. So Sackett family lives in Idaho. They purchased approximately half-acre property near Priest Lake, which is a tourist destination. They purchased a property within a subdivision with a number of houses around. It had been established for a neighborhood for a number of years. And like many landowners, the Sacketts began to develop the property, bringing in fill material to level it out and to bring the house up above some wet areas on the property. Very shortly after they began these activities, EPA arrived at the site, ordered them to cease and desist with developing the property, that it was EPA's belief that it was jurisdictional wetlands. The Sackett family disagreed with EPA's opinion, but in the interim, the agency issued the Sacketts a compliance order directing the Sacketts to restore the land to pre-development and removing fill material. The Sacketts and the order had an enforcement provision that if the Sacketts failed to restore the area, they were subject to $32,500 per day civil penalties if they failed to comply with the order. Obviously, the Sacketts disagreed with EPA's jurisdictional determination and sought to challenge that. EPA at the time said that the agency action was not final, and which essentially prevented the Sacketts from seeking a court resolution and opinion based on the merits. And that case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And that first Sackett decision really had to deal with a procedural element to the Clean Water Act and whether or not they could seek judicial redress under the Administrative Procedures Act. That case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and conservative and liberal justices at the time all agreed that it was final agency decision and that the Sacketts had a right to seek judicial relief. So fast forward a little over 10 years, and the Sacketts find themselves before the Supreme Court again. And this issue was really whether or not those wetlands were in fact, waters of the U.S. subject to federal jurisdiction. And the court concluded 9-0 that they were not federally protected wetlands. It was a 5-4 majority decision. So there was a majority opinion. However, Justice Kavanaugh, one of the conservative justices and the liberal justices, disagreed on the majority opinion and the rationale going forward. So it's a very interesting decision. We can dive into the details of it. And I think that may be useful for your audience.
Yeah.
So backing up to the last, the Supreme Court has had four bites at the apple on the issue of wetland jurisdiction. I have been working in this area for several decades. Started my career actually doing wetland delineations and jurisdictional determinations in North Carolina and the coastal areas of North Carolina, and have spent the better part of my legal career advising clients on these very issues. So it, you know, there's several cases, Riverside Bayview, back in I believe it was 1991. It was 2001, where the court basically said adjacent wetlands to traditional navigable waters were subject to federal jurisdiction. Then there was the Swank decision and the most recent Rapanos decision. You know, this is all very, can be all very confusing to non-lawyers and to landowners who tried to figure out, you know, what is developable and what is not. I think the courts in this case got closer to getting it right. The Rapanos decision, prior decisions have muddied the water, so to speak. But I think the Sackett, most recent Sackett decision, got closer to what I believe was the intent of Congress. Although conservative Justice Kavanaugh disagreed with the majority opinion. And I think that's where a lot of the focus is in the fallout is going to be. And that really has to do with adjacent, the protection under the Clean Water Act of adjacent wetlands. Just so in sum, the majority opinion concluded that waters of the U.S. are those that have, or wetlands are jurisdictional if they have a continuous surface water connection to traditionally navigable waters. I think it's really important for your listeners to understand that the Clean Water Act, when it was adopted back in 1972, Congress tethered the federal government's jurisdiction to navigation. Mm. Those waters that were subject to commerce, you can think of those waters as lakes and rivers where you could kayak and canoe and navigate from the oceans up to the tributaries. But Congress also included a reference to adjacent wetlands were subject to, so wetlands adjacent to these traditional navigable waters or other covered waters were subject to jurisdiction. And that is where I think this court really struggled. Justice Alito, who rendered the opinion in the most recent Sackett decision, adopted Justice Scalia's plurality opinion in the Rapanos case. And that, again, was whether or not there was a continuous surface water connection. So I'm going to stop there and see if there's questions or issues that you'd like to address.
So in sum, there's no longer the phrase significant nexus.
Correct. Correct. Yeah.
Which was Justice Anthony's position.
That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Justice Kennedy in the Rapanos decision, it was a split fragmented court 414 decision where Justice Kennedy rendered an opinion that said jurisdiction existed over wetlands where there was a significant nexus to traditional waters. Now, significant nexus was never defined under the Clean or never used under the Clean Water Act, but it essentially Justice Kennedy's opinion and the theory of jurisdiction was that waters were the significant nexus existed either if a wetland alone or in combination with other nearby lands had a significant effect on the chemical, biological integrity of covered waters. And that created a lot of confusion, and it made a lot of landowners, it created jurisdiction over isolated wetlands where those waters many times would not be subject to jurisdiction. And the landowner did not know whether or not there were similarly situated lands in the area that would then apply jurisdiction over their own land. So it created lots of confusion. It created Lots of work for consultants, very expensive for a landowner to go out and hire consultants to determine what in fact was subject to jurisdiction. And many landowners, because of the cost associated with hiring consultants to determine what was jurisdictional or what is not, in many cases, landowners and businesses and developers conceded jurisdiction over certain lands and proceeded with getting permits, even though in many cases those lands may not have been subject to jurisdiction in the first place.
Yeah. They're the transaction costs of doing business. Look, we just need to build our subdivision, our commercial properties. Let's just get it done instead of fight about it. Right.
That's right. That's correct. Yeah.
Well, take me, and I know that you're not providing legal advice to anyone here on this episode, but as a lawyer, I'd like to think that lawyers are very good about considerations of the future, about the parade of horribles, right? We can sit down with clients and look at all the permutations and combinations of, you know, the ambiguity in particular judicial opinions, regulations, policies. Go back over your career and think about the past and how you've looked at the cases you cited to, you know, Bayview, Swank, Rapanos, and think about how, in your mind, you've had to consider how your advice to different clients has sort of changed over time, and whether you've been able to say clearly this is what's going to happen, or, you know, these are the risks that are out there. And it may differ depending on the client that you may be talking to, whether it's a manufacturer, a water utility, a commercial developer, things like that. Take us back to how you viewed some of these cases and the types of things that were going through your mind over the last 10 to 20 years.
Sure. Well, as you know, this is not legal advice. These are my own opinions based on several decades of working in this space. So first of all, I think there's been there's a lot of concern by environmentalists and conservationists that this decision is really, really bad and horrible. And there's no doubt that today, many wetlands that were protected last week are no longer protected under federal jurisdiction. Having said that, however, I think a lot of people forget that states have jurisdiction over these waters, state waters. And the vast majority of states actually regulate any development within these wetlands. So it's not as if yesterday there was protection and today there's no protection. There is less federal protection than there was last week. And that has its pros and cons. There's no doubt some states, pro-development states, will hail this decision and allow more development than other states. But having said that, I really do think that, you know, if I'm talking to environmental groups that you know, clients that advised conservation and environmental groups in the past, my recommendation to them is really focus on the state. Try to get, if the state does not have protections over things like vernal pool, well, most states do have protections over these isolated waters, but there's going to be some of these wetlands, clearly isolated wetlands that have very little ecological value. You know, the question is, you know, should a state then regulate even the smallest of wetlands, depressional areas? And what I've said to my clients in the past, not every wetland is created equal. Some wetlands like vernal pools, potholes, prairie potholes, other wetlands, you know, in headwaters of these estuaries are extremely important ecologically. But I also think what I remind them is EPA does not have the authority, the Corps does not have the authority under the Act to protect wildlife habitat or ecologically sensitive habitat. Truly, the Clean Water Act was to protect water quality. And so I think the biggest concern that I have based on this decision are going to be those wetlands that are divided from jurisdictional waters, covered waters, things, wetlands on one side of a roadway, on the other side of a a dike or some type of berm or even a sand dune that does not have a continuous flow to covered waters. And so those, I think, are probably, and many of those wetlands are going to be in floodplain areas. So I think it's going to be incumbent upon states in those groups to really focus on how ensuring that the state protections for those waters exist. Because as we know, wetlands provide much flood mitigation and, you know, water quality infiltration and other water quality improvements when they are in close proximity to those covered waters. If I'm advising industry, I think and landowners, I think right now, before they proceed with developing what they view as a isolated wetland, they need to check to make sure that the states don't regulate those. And if they do, then they have to seek permits. So you're right. It's a different message to different clients, but I think this is all very manageable.
Yeah. And you have to think about, the terms, winners and losers, it may be relative depending upon the type of individual organization you are, and it may become winning today but losing tomorrow or in the future.
Correct.
You highlighted one of my questions, and I'll just tie it in now. But over the past, if I hear you correctly, you have observed that many of these proposed regulations, policy determinations, and even judicial opinions have been less than clear. And you have, over the past many years, talked to different clients about not only the opportunities, but the risks that you see some of these determinations being cast aside. And one of the outcomes that I think I hear you talking about is, going forward, you may see tremendous activity at the state level to reinforce the protection of wetlands. If I'm in Illinois, for example, if I'm a client of yours in Illinois, I may see significant activity over the next several legislative sessions to reinforce the protection of intra-state wetlands. And that's something, as a client, I'd want to know about.
Certainly.
I may need to, work with lobbyists to make sure the legislation is fair and reasonable. Or if I'm an environmental organization, I want to work to move quickly to strengthen those intrastate wetland regulations. And so some companies, for example, they may face 50 different, but maybe similar, but different intrastate wetland regulatory systems, both on permitting, compliance, and enforcement. Is that fair?
That's actually fair, but it's the way it's been in the past before, that even those waters that were not subject to jurisdiction, federal jurisdiction, were in many cases subject to state jurisdiction and permitting. Yeah. I think what's really interesting, and I think what's somewhat tragic about this, and obviously the pendulum and these policy decisions and court cases will swing depending upon the makeup of the court. Yeah, I think the court's response in many cases is based on, and you see this in Judge Alito's opinion, really scolding both the Corps and EPA for what they perceive as ignoring the court's prior decisions and restraints on their own authority. And and I do think it's unfortunate in many cases where, if you look at and if you step back for a second, the Clean Water Act has not been amended, the jurisdiction, since 1977. Mm-hmm. The text hasn't changed, but what has changed is the agency's interpretation of the act, and it has expanded. So I think it's somewhat unfortunate that the agency over the years have increasingly expanded their authority. Just remind you of the Swank decision that the court struck down and rebuked the agency for implementing what was called the migratory bird rule. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a rule at all. It was actually a reference and a preamble to a rule that basically said, if a wetland or water body, isolated water body, could support a migratory bird, it was subject to federal jurisdiction. Well, that's essentially every most every water body, and that became known as the glancing goose test. So even after the Swank decision and in that decision, the Supreme Court restricted the agency's authority. Very quickly, the agencies kind of regained and recollected their expansive authorities on what they under the significant nexus or what they called the what many of us call the migratory molecule rule. So if it wasn't birds that were establishing jurisdiction, it was any connection with water. And as we know, water runs downhill. Water, groundwater, surface water, eventually, you know, waters connect underground or surface somehow. Yeah. And so EPA and the Corps asserted, again, very broad jurisdiction after the Swank decision. And then that brought about the Rapanos decision where, you know, we talked about then the test, significant nexus test. So it's all been is murky as mud to many landowners.
The an observation, and then I'll ask a question. It seems to me, and you touched on this, that they seem to be slapping the hand of EPA and the Corps. And as we learn in college and even in law school, we have four branches of government, right? We have the administrative, the administrative branch. And you politely suggested that over the last several decades, the EPA and the Corps may have been trying to expand their authority, their rule over certain areas, absent clear authority from Congress. And here we have a lot of cases where these administrative agencies are being reined in, so to speak. But yes. Is this decision, and maybe I'll give you my opinion, is this real decision really a wink and nod, maybe not so surreptitiously, to Congress? And as you pointed out, many of us were in elementary school when the last amendment to the Clean Water Act was accomplished. But is this really Congress's problem? And that's where, when we think about the future of this matter, this, you know, what is a wetland and how should it be regulated? Is this really the Supreme Court saying the symptom of lack of legislative clarity and action? Yes. It is something that we are really concerned about, wink, wink. What does that say about the future of water and in particular wetlands? I mean, we could expand this to Safe Drinking Water Act or other water-focused federal programs where perhaps Congress is sitting on many different programs that lack clarity. And right. Whether you are on one side of the issue or the other, whether you're an environmental advocacy group or a business group, you want some certainty and clarity. You may not like it, but you want clarity. And do you think that, well, let me ask you the question. What do you see over the next 10 to 20 years from decisions like Sackett for federal legislative action to clarify things in the world of water? Do you see Congress, the scenario is, hey, it's going to be business as usual, Matt. Or, you know, I think people are getting tired of all this administrative wrangling and, judicial, interference, if you will, or determinations. And we need Congress to act one way or the other. Do you see something transformational, perhaps? What are your thoughts in terms of the next 10 to 20 years? More of the same? Or will something happen that we are not expecting?
Well, to your first question, it has been an abdication by Congress. There's been great acquiescence to the agencies who have filled the ambiguities and the gray areas with their own interpretation of jurisdiction. And what I would just say again, it was the a real pleasure and kind of a highlight of my career to serve at EPA as the principal deputy assistant administrator in the Office of Water. So I was there when the Rapanos decision came down, and we tried to make a rulemaking based on a 414 decision, fragmented courts. So it's not easy to, you know, to have this back and forth between between the courts and these decisions that go back and forth. But what I would say is Congress absolutely needs to respond. If you recall Chief Justice Roberts' concurring decision in Rapanos, basically blamed Congress for the confusion that existed, and really urged Congress to do its job. We are a divided country. Obviously, there's increased disagreement across the political aisle, but I'm an eternal optimist, and I do believe that there are opportunities for Congress to get this correct. You know, 2009, Congress sought to, in response to Swank, sought to pass what was the Clean Water Restoration Act that would remove the term navigability from the Clean Water Act. But many Republicans and those concerned about, again, EPA's increased jurisdictional authority pushed back on that. That bill was never adopted. I do think that reasonable minds can find compromise. I think areas like, you know, important ecological systems like prairie potholes that are absolutely critical to waterfowl and vernal ponds and others, the federal government, there's ways that I think federal jurisdiction may be appropriate. But, you know, I have long, as I said earlier, not every wetland is created equal. And that's what I think that has been the biggest rub to a lot of landowners and lawyers and others who may disagree with EPA and the Corps' interpretation and putting this blanket authority over every single wetland, notwithstanding the ecological value or the water quality value of those wetlands. So I've always believed that Congress could pass a new law that would recognize the different qualities of these wetlands. And so if you have a wetland depressional area, small puddle, so to speak, on a piece of property like the Sacketts, rather than imposing the full force of the Clean Water Act, potential criminal penalties and the like, as we've seen, maybe there's a way to allow, faster permitting of those. And as we know, there are pretty innovative private solutions like wetland banking, wetland banking systems where you could then purchase credits from an eco entrepreneur who has established or restored a degraded wetland. So I think there are many ways to respond positively to this decision. I do appreciate and understand environmentalist concerns about the potential impact on water quality and wildlife habitat, you know, ecological value of these wetlands. But they're going to have to work with their states. They may. So we talked about there's going to be probably a lot of state activity right now where there hasn't been previously. And I think there's a chance that we could see members in Congress, both left and right, that could come together and say, listen, this back and forth is not healthy. The lack of clarity, the cost associated with protecting wetlands, notwithstanding their ecological value or value to water quality, we can fix this. So that remains to be seen, but I do expect that we will see some action.
Here's a scenario. I'm going to go back into my Wayback Machine, and I'll ask you to join me. 1976 is the rise of the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, and it took a couple years for the regulations to come out in May of 1980, and Congress was not happy with how EPA was implementing the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, and so in 1984, they passed the Hazardous and Solid Waste Amendments. And within that, as many students of RCRA will remember, were the hammer provisions. And I'm going to call these the FEWL hammer provisions for the Clean Water Act. That's what I'll do in honor of you. But could there be, as you point out, people coming together with Congress and putting into a Clean Water Act proposal, particular provisions that are very detailed and clear that will operate much like the hammer provisions did for RCRA. You either get this out as a rule, or these provisions will take place as a matter of statute, not as a matter of rule. Could you see that type of scenario coming about where different groups are maybe tired of the last 40 to 50 years of wrangling over these things? And could there be these types of very specific provisions put into a piece of legislation rather than perhaps what we've seen over the last decade, yeah, or, you know, where it's just Congress wants to get reelected and they abdicate their, yeah, their role to EPA or the Corps or other, you know, other, you know, anonymous agencies? Do you see those provisions that, you know, and I'm going to request that they call them, they name them after you.
Well,
so you're famous. So that's a bad, yeah, maybe that's a bad parallel, but do you see those things happening?
Possibly. As you know, Matt, there has been great trepidation with the divide in our country, Republican-Democrat divide, on reopening these statutes to amend them, for fear that one side will lose control of the process and end up on the short end of the stick. But I do think there's another case, you know, before the Supreme Court that I think could force some solution like that to come to fruition. And that's the challenge to Chevron deference. For years, under the Chevron case, courts have given a substantial deference to the agency on its interpretations, where there's ambiguity in the statutory language. And as we know, these laws in many cases aren't clear, and it's by design. It's a compromise. Many times, these statutes are through compromise, where neither side wants to bring clarity because of the concern of losing some authority or having to deal with something that addressing an issue that would crater the entire adoption of something. So they leave some ambiguity.
Right.
And so, you know, that's definitely a flaw to the legislative process. But I do think that, as you point out, that there are options to provide greater clarity. And we'll see if there's enough members in Congress, moderates, who can help craft those solutions and create, you know, sufficient support to adopt something like that. But right now, it's hard to see that happening unless there's some other forcing event.
Yeah, I suppose if I'm a congressperson, I am watching that Chevron deference case with great interest. I'll use that word. Chevron deference elimination equals I have to do my job, right?
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And maybe that's what Congress needs.
Yeah.
Congress perhaps needs to understand that they can't simply rely upon the administrative state to interpret what they fail to do.
What it seems that I hear maybe a business as usual outcome with the potential for some unintended consequences from the Sackett decision and even the Chevron deference case, however that's decided. Do you believe maybe you can consider for us a handful, two or three of what you see are unintended consequences coming out from the Sackett decision over the next 10 to 20 years? So people today are probably happy or sad, and yet maybe in 10 to 20 years that emotion will flip depending on the particular party or organization. Your thoughts on some of the unintended consequences from Sackett?
Thinking about that, I think one that comes to mind immediately is obviously the concern over adjacent wetlands, those that are separated by barriers. You know, Justice Alito kind of dismissed Justice Kavanaugh's concerns about adjacent wetlands that were separated by barriers, and basically said, well, that, you know, illegally created barriers is not going to be a barrier for EPA's authority to assert jurisdiction over those wetlands that might be cut off from a continuous surface connection. But that doesn't address the issue of legal barriers that are erected. So, for example, roadways and even driveways that previously could be implemented. You know, the agency is going. What's interesting about and kind of amusing, it's not amusing, but in its own way, but the agencies will try to find a way to claw back as much jurisdiction as they can, even under the Sackett decision. And so to the extent that the agency can identify a continuous surface connection, that will enable them to continue to assert authority. So I can see more stringent regulations over roadways and highways and other construction that may potentially sever those connections. So I think it could drive up the cost of permitting and even construction because of the effort to, you know, to preserve those connections.
You may see a more focused and aggressive pursuit of compliance and enforcement activities by EPA over other public agencies, you know, a DOT, a state DOT, a city for permitting violations, things
certainly,
like that.
Yeah. Certainly. Certainly. Okay. But I do think, again, and I think about green infrastructure, as you're aware, many municipalities have sought to adopt green infrastructure as a more cost-effective way of dealing with stormwater. And you know, it's allowing Mother Nature, including wetlands and, you know, created wetlands, natural and developed wetlands, as a way to polish stormwater. So I think to some degree, this decision, there will be winners on that side for green infrastructure, simply because it will be easier for communities to adopt green infrastructure, because the concern was there were so many, not all regions of EPA kind of embraced the green infrastructure imposed so many requirements, burdensome requirements on a municipality to adopt green infrastructure that many communities just threw up their hands and said, we're not going to do it. We just can't do it. It's too difficult.
Right.
So I think under this decision, things like wet ponds and green infrastructure, drainages that are no longer jurisdictional, it'll be easier to adopt those green infrastructure practices, and communities may be more interested and willing to do so. And as we know, green infrastructure, many conservation communities, you know, embrace and those types of practices as opposed to gray infrastructure. It's more aesthetically pleasing. Sometimes you can get better water quality. Many value to green infrastructure. So I think in some ways, this may be beneficial to advancing green infrastructure in those communities that might not otherwise have attempted it.
That's a good observation. So perhaps the number of LEED certified structures will increase dramatically, at least ones that focus on that particular water issue.
Certainly could
getting points
be an outcome.
Yeah, right. Even maybe state financing authorities will find more opportunities to push more grants or low interest loans to municipalities for that type of activity.
I think that very well could be.
So. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. One of the things that I think we've already covered, obviously, would be an increase in state related legislative or regulatory activity on, you know, intrastate wetlands. Do you believe that, even though, as you correctly pointed out, there are frameworks in place at the state level, do you see some nuanced legislative activity to further reinforce interstate permitting programs given the Sackett decision? Or is there just a level of comfort that, well, if EPA doesn't have jurisdiction, we automatically have jurisdiction and we'll just continue moving forward? Or are there some issues that you see coming about?
Yeah, well, I think it's going to depend upon the state, Matt. I think there's going to be some states, again, that feel pretty comfortable already that they regulate. You know, I think where a lot of environmentalists have concerns is that, obviously, under state law, you don't have the citizen suit provision, and there's many protections under the Clean Water Act that simply some states do not have. I think... I would certainly like to see some states develop their requirements and regulations that differentiate between wetlands and the quality of those wetlands, the ecological value, the water quality value. And as I said, in those areas where there's already development, allowing an expedited or perhaps, there is, federal government, EPA, has general permits. States have their own general permits, perhaps adopting a general permit system that makes it easier to develop in those areas where you have interstate wetlands that are not high quality value and cannot be restored. I think we will see some of that innovative thinking, and I'm hopeful that industry stakeholders and conservation groups can come together and agree on those wetlands that absolutely must be protected, and those that, while subject to regulation, do not need as much protection. And perhaps, again, can shift that those impacts to some type of mitigation through, you know, a wetland bank where a developer could, you know, more easily go out and purchase credits for destroying or developing a wetland that was not of great value.
Yeah. One of the brief passing comments that is of interest to us, I think, is the observation about criminal environmental enforcement. And the court has here and there expressed concern over, let's just take the Sacketts. It's not just administrative penalties or civil penalties, but somebody could go to jail for these ambiguous declarations about what is or isn't a wetland. And the court seems to be a little worried about that. And do you think that that is an issue that will change the nature of the clarity, whether it's wetlands or point source discharges or RCRA or the Clean Air Act? Do you think that there's a bit of a message to Congress or even the EPA about providing some enhanced clarity as to what is or may be considered an environmental crime?
Well, certainly I think this decision creates greater clarity on what is jurisdictional, what is not. As you rightly point out, when the Clean Water Act was adopted, Congress adopted some pretty punitive mechanisms, including criminal enforcement. And unlike some statutes, mens rea is not at issue. So one need not know or intend to break the law in order to be subject to criminal penalty. What my concern is, a lot of time when a decision like this comes down, where EPA, you know, where you may have some developers or others who push the envelope, where they simply go out and develop lands that may still be subject to EPA jurisdiction. I think there's always this tendency by the agency to increase enforcement and to more vigorously enforce, to send a message to developers and landowners that criminal sanctions are still, you know, they're still subject to criminal penalties for violating. Right. And so the clarity is not clear in this, you know, if I could say that clarity is not clear here. That was one of the challenges when I was a professional out in the field, trying to determine within a watershed, going from, you know, if you could take a canoe from the ocean up through the, you know, rivers, up through the tributaries, both the perennial and then intermittent, you know, at some point along that path, federal interest end and state interest begin. And that was always a very difficult decision. I think it was clearer in the past, where the Corps of Engineers used criteria and markers such as the ordinary high water mark on streams, which in many cases they still do. But over time, as we talked about, the agencies increased their jurisdiction over dry riverbeds out west, the dry auroras, which are simply erosional features that over time, and they do have some ecological value, but again, there's very little value in terms of water quality to traditional navigable waters. But, you know, over time, those dry erosional features were brought into the jurisdictional family. So, any event, it's...
No, nobody wants to go to jail over a mistake.
No.
Nobody wants to rely on the opinion of an environmental scientist, right? And then have that,
That's right.
You know, and be used against them.
And Matt, you know, my experience is there's, you know, these rules and EPA's interpretation, it's not always fair. And I recall when I was at the agency, and I was the head of the congressional office, and got a call from a member of Congress whose family was being prosecuted by the federal government for alleged violations of the Clean Water Act for agricultural, for their farm in Virginia. And this congresswoman called and said that she and her family had tried to get a hearing before EPA for 2 years, but nobody would listen to them, or they would be unable to meet. And I said, Congresswoman, you know, my view is every citizen of the U.S. has the right to redress the federal government for a grievance. And I said, I made no promises, but I went to the head of EPA's enforcement, and I said, and in this case, there was lots of equities and unfairness built in. The family had actually contacted the Corps of Engineers. Corps of Engineers had come out, and as you know, Matt, the regulations over agricultural wetlands is very complicated and nuanced. And so the congresswoman and her family wanted to do the right thing. So they had the Corps of Engineer come out and visibly show them what areas of their property they could develop and farm and what they couldn't. Well, fast forward a couple of years later, EPA disagreed with the Corps, and EPA has primacy or primary authority, and sometimes many cases does overrule the Corps of Engineers. But in this case, EPA brought an enforcement action, and so we were able to have a meeting with the family. They brought the lawyers in, consultant, and very quickly that case was resolved. But what it really struck me then was how unfair it could be for landowners who were trying to do the right thing but made a mistake. Well, in this case, they didn't even make a mistake. It was simply a disagreement between the Corps and the EPA, and they were caught in the middle of that. So in any event, as we know, the law and enforcement can be rough and tumble. Enforcement serves an important purpose. Clean Water Act and protection of wetlands, jurisdictional waters, is a serious business. I don't criticize EPA and the Corps lightly, but I do believe that there have been cases where mistakes have been made, honest mistakes by landowners, and they've paid dearly for it. And the Sackett family is frankly one of those, where even the liberal justices in 2012 were appalled at the agency's decision to deny the Sackett family the right to seek redress before a court.
Yeah, a lot of due process issues that we could have on another talk about another podcast.
Two-hour podcast.
So. Yes, fascinating. I wonder myself whether there will be over the next 10 to 20 years a change in disposition or posture by these federal agencies. Will they simmer down in terms of how they attempt to assert jurisdiction over things or provide clarity? Will they just simply become more assertive over the next 10 to 20 years?
I think time will tell.
Yeah, we will show you who's in charge, right? Especially given how some people react to the intersection of science and law or policy, politics, where, we understand how water is virtually entirely interconnected in many senses. And so trying to say, well, there's surface water in this bucket, and over there there's groundwater, and over there in another bucket is wetlands. And we understand those hydrogeological principles. Obviously, when you propose, enact legislation, many people don't seem to remember that you're trying to attack a particular issue. And if we go back into our Wayback Machine again, what was the intent of the Clean Water Act, right?
To address
the pollution of wetlands, or to address those ugly point source discharges into the rivers. Which leads us back into, is it a future where Congress will more meaningfully act with greater clarity and precision?
Yeah. Well, so, as you were as you recall, again, Congress was pretty clear on some things, including, you know, restricting EPA authority in the Clean Water Act for things like groundwater. Mm-hmm. Groundwater was you know, off limits. It was still subject to EPA or to the state authorities, as was development and use of water resources. And as you rightly point out, I think science has advanced beyond the law. So when the Clean Water Act was adopted, we knew that the rivers were polluted, and we knew that many discharges from the end of pipe, which are permitted under and regulated under the 402 program, were right. absolutely critical. Right. And so we have made significant improvements to water quality and reductions of pollutant. But Congress also told EPA and the Corps that it did not have authority over non-point sources, and told the federal government to work cooperatively with the state to address the sources of non-point source pollution. As we know, as you know, most of the pollution challenges, big hairy problems that we have with water quality these days are not from point sources. They are from non-point sources, millions and millions of non-point sources. Right. That are contributing to pollution to the Chesapeake Bay, the Gulf of Mexico, many of our rivers. And EPA doesn't have the regulatory authority to directly permit and regulate those. So I think we, you know, there may be an interest going forward in compromises where, you know, we can be more creative. I think there may be greater courage to perhaps reopen the Clean Water Act to some innovative approaches. But again, that to do that, it's going to require our trust.
Yeah.
And I don't see a whole lot of trust across the aisle these days. So I really do think it's going to depend upon, you know, the administration and the leadership to be able to forge those types of compromises.
Yeah. To oversimplify it, it seems that many of the federal environmental laws that were enacted, you know, 50 years ago were trying to address particular issues, challenges, acute problems, and it's as if they were passing laws to address the challenges of typewriters and fax machines, and here we are today with the internet and smartphones. How do we come to grips with perhaps federal statutory provisions and even federal regulatory provisions that may not clearly help us address today's problems? And who's going to demonstrate the leadership over the next 10 to 20 years to
resolve
those
challenges?
Well, I
think we can point, and you make some really good points. I mean, the statutes, in my view and many professional view, are outdated. They've done a great job, the Clean Water Act, addressing point sources, but obviously it has not been able to address non-point source. I will point to examples of statutes that have been amended in successfully, and TSCA would be one where there was some real barriers to effectively regulating industry chemicals, and both Democrats and Republicans came together and said, well, TSCA is broken, so let's find a way to fix it. And that happened, and it wasn't without challenges, but you know, in the end, TSCA is a much, much more effective statute than it used to be.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my final questions to you is, looking at SACCET and thinking about the next 10 to 20 years, what are two or three things that you might offer to particular types of clients as they think about the impacts of SACCET over the next 10 to 20 years? What are some considerations or observations to various types of hypothetical clients as they consider the going forward impacts of SACCET?
Yeah, and we've touched upon some of those. So first of all, it depends upon the clients and their needs. I do think that, you know, permitting, the issue of permitting, Congress is grappling with that. Permitting things like renewable energy facilities and pipelines and other things, permitting new renewable energy facilities is stuck in the stuck in the quagmire of permitting, NEPA and, you know, Clean Water Act permitting and other things. So I think that what I would recommend, you know, to these clients is try to find a way to find innovative or better solutions to that which we know needs to be done, and that's updating our infrastructure. And I think we're seeing, you know, we're seeing Congress consider those types of permitting reforms. But I do think that ultimately these types of best solutions in many cases come from compromise, and not one side is going to be happy with everything that they get. But, you know, when I go out and I speak to college kids and high school kids about, you know, an environmental career, what I always tell them is many of these solutions, that logical solutions and best solutions that exist, are not going to occur without trusting other people to work with you. So, you know, Republicans care about the environment just as much as Democrats. They may just have a different solution. But so my recommendation, again, is to find ways to work with those that you may disagree with, to find some, you know, some solutions that would protect the resource, and, you know, also protect the economy.
Yeah.
Jobs.
I like that. I think number one, you're saying it's not necessarily a legal or scientific going forward recommendation. It's more of a interpersonal or a leadership recommendation, which is, okay, clients, hold on before you either cry or celebrate. We need to redouble our efforts to build trust, to build advanced relationships with all of the governmental public officials that we deal with, federal or state, local, because we're not maybe quite sure what's going to happen over the next 10 to 20 years.
Right.
But we need to demonstrate to them that this decision doesn't change our commitment to the environment. Is that
that's
fair?
That's exactly right. That's a fair characterization.
Yeah. Do you see, I'll offer my number two here. Do you see the potential over the next 10 to 20 years for a bit of a renaissance when it comes to federal environmental law, whether it's wholehearted approach, a holistic approach, or piecemeal? But do you see parties coming together, as you point out in your first point, to try to provide clarity over some of these federal environmental laws to provide predictability? And I know, for example, you know, nobody thought President Trump would become President Trump, right? I mean, and here he is, right? He became president. And so we may sit here today and say, Matt, you know, come on, it's not realistic. I mean, we can trust each other, but politics, as you pointed out, we're a divided country, right? Yeah. Come on, I don't trust this guy, right? It'll go out and go to the conference committee after it goes through the Senate or whatever, and someone will change it. And so do you think there's still that opportunity for a bit of a renaissance where, you know, it's been 50 years or what have you, it's time to kind of rejuvenate and modernize these antiquated laws?
Yeah.
Is that something that you could see 10 to 20 years from now?
I certainly think it's a possibility, and it's something that I certainly strive for in my everyday dealings with others that care about these issues, regardless of their politics. And I would just note, you know, Conserve America is a nonprofit that I work with that reaches across the aisle to try to find pragmatic solutions to these big challenges that, you know, that are new challenges, new environmental issues that have arisen, since the 1970s, like climate change, resiliency, and other things that we need to be able to work together on. And so I do see that. I do see, and I'm optimistic that the younger generation is probably growing weary of the partisan bickering and fighting that basically prevents common sense solutions and approaches to being adopted. So I do think that, you know, and out of this younger generation, I'm hopeful and remain optimistic that we'll see some new leadership that will come forward, that will buck party politics for what's in the best interest of our country and the environment. We can always hope for, you know, hope it springs eternal on a better way to move forward.
Well, I appreciate your cautious optimism. It is very difficult to emerge from the cocoon of cynicism over these environmental issues. It seems that things take time, and over your career, you may see such, you know, little change. And as you point out, there could be the millennials, the Gen Z, those folks who will want to move forward with a different right. set of values and a different way of getting things done. And we will see what happens over the next 10 to 20 years. And Brent, I want to thank you for being a tremendous guest today on the Water Foresight podcast. And tell us where folks can get a hold of you if they have questions or comments about Sackett or other water-related challenges.
Right. Well, Matt, it's been great to be on your program. Hopefully, your guests have learned a little bit more. They are welcome to reach out to me and my partners at Earth and Water Law website online. They can reach us online anytime if they just care to have a coffee and want to talk about policy, or you know, or if they have legal challenges that they need expert opinion and advice with. So we're happy to have those conversations.
Thank you for listening to the Water Foresight podcast powered by the Aqualaris Group. For more information, please visit us at aqualaris.com or follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter.